This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 65th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me today my friend Giovanni Vigna. Hi, Giovanni.
Hey, Gary. It's great to be here on Silver Bullet.
Thanks. Giovanni Vigna is a professor of computer science at UC Santa Barbara. His work focuses on web security, vulnerability analysis, malware countermeasures, and intrusion detection. Dr. Vigna is co-director of the UCSB Security Lab and is a member of the Shellfish and Epic Fail Hacker Collectives. Giovanni also founded the WebWise Security, a security consulting firm, and he organizes the International Capture the Flag Hacking Competition every year. Giovanni lives in Santa Barbara, California, with his family, including two toddlers, a boy and a girl, under two, and his hair is now very short.
Good call.
So thanks for joining us today, Giovanni.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
I just returned from my first ever trip to Black Hat, believe it or not, my first, where I was surprised and somewhat disappointed by how little security engineering was going on. There was plenty of breaking and lots of really cool hacks, but not much building of stuff. And I guess one of the highlights of DEF CON, which is closely associated with Black Hat since it happens right after it, is this Capture the Flag contest, which is sort of all about breaking and penetration. I want to talk about that, and then I want to switch back to my earlier intro. So can you explain how Capture the Flag works at DEF CON and how your team Shellfish won in 2005?
Absolutely. So the Capture the Flag at DEF CON is a hacking competition. And the basic idea is that all the teams participating receive the same server, virtualized server. Sometimes it's a VMware machine. Sometimes is a sort of a partition over a shared host. Called a jail, technically. But the basic idea is that everybody obtains the same server with the same vulnerable services. And the game is to find the vulnerabilities in your services, in your server, patch your version of the application, and use the knowledge about the bug to break into everybody else's services.
Ah, so now, there is a fair amount of security engineering built into that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, most of the skills that are required are reverse engineering and exploit development skills. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have those, you will not be able to break into the services and capture the flag.
Right.
But there is also a lot of defense that has to happen. And actually, for example, for this particular edition this year, we had prepared a very sophisticated proxying system that will take all the traffic, send it to this thing that would scrub it and present it to us for with anomalies identified and all this thing, which of course went through the drain when they announced that everything would be running on IP version 6, for which we were not even remotely ready. Nobody knew anything about it.
And was so anybody ready, or was it just a total flyer?
It was a pretty total flyer. I'm sure there was somebody that was ready. We definitely were not. So we were like looking at each other like, and now what? And the next 2 hours was going, you know, on the internet, figuring out how you set up routes, how you do, you know, DHCP or IP assignment. I mean, it was just crazy. But that's the thing, the part of the game is that you learn so much by being in a situation where in a short amount of time, you have to solve a very difficult problem.
Mm-hmm. So explain a little bit about how you guys won the contest in 2005. What made your approach better than others at that time?
Well, probably the other teams were not as good as the other years, I guess. I think that what really worked is a good balance between defense and attack. And I must say that our team has always been very, very good at attacking and at developing exploits, and not as good as developing defenses, and not as not because we don't know how to defend, is that when you're there and you're working, you know, everybody wants to, you know, develop exploits and do reverse engineering. It's very difficult for people. It takes a lot of discipline during a competition where you're trying to have fun to say, okay, I'm going to sit down and set up the firewall rules. Nobody wants to do that, right? Or, let me check. I'm going to, you know, trace this thing and make sure that only executes the system calls that it's supposed to. Nobody, it sounds like, you know, the person that is cleaning up the room while everybody else is, you know, having fights with lightsabers. you don't want to be that person.
So, I guess there were a lot of people on the Death Star that had to do that, though.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing that is interesting is that year, I think we had a fantastic team. And because I take my students, I mean, Shellfish has been exclusively UCSB grad students and then became UCSB postdoc, UCSB professors. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, Chris Krugel also plays on it. I think that the person, the team, the humans participating are the real key people.
Right.
Of course, you need certain skills, but really the team is what makes a difference. And I'm sure that it's also what you found in the industry in general. You know, having the right tools is very important, but having the right people is everything.
Mm-hmm. So now you've established the largest hacking contest in the world. That's the International Capture the Flag contest.
That is correct.
Tell us about that and tell us who participates.
So that started initially very early in 2001 as an internal sort of hacking competition in my grad class on vulnerability analysis. But then, you know, we were going to DEF CON, and we, of course, you know, at the very beginning, we pretty much copied the DEF CON idea. But we decided that we wanted to have, instead of a localized competition, because at DEF CON you have 12 teams playing in one big room at the competition. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have something that, A, was a little easier, so that students that just went through 3 months of or a semester of security training could actually learn something. You know, DEF CON is sort of hardcore. I mean, you're thrown there. If you don't understand something, they say, well, that's your problem.
Right. Too bad for you.
The International Capture the Flag is like, oh, let me help you with this. You need to set up a VPN link? Absolutely. Here's the person who can help you with that. So the attitude is completely different. The goal is not to prove that you're the best hacker, but is, you know, to really learn about security and how to attack and defend in a fun setting. And also it allows teams to connect remotely, so we can scale pretty easily. And our last edition was 78 teams, 1,000 people playing for 8 hours, and it was a great success.
That's great. How many countries were represented among those 78 teams?
I don't have it top of my head. I would say probably 16, mm-hmm. something like that.
But
we have people from all over, you know, from, of course, United States, a lot of Europeans. The Russian teams are always very, very good. We have South America represented, Asia, India, and China. It's very nice.
So I have to give a shout out to our co-sponsor of Silver Bullet, the IEEE S&P magazine, who I guess is a sponsor of the ICTF too.
Absolutely, absolutely. They provided cash prizes for the first time. It was quite a bit different. You know, all the other times, the only thing that the winner would get is the bragging rights. To have won this competition, but now they got also a check. And if I were a grad student, I would be like, yeah, forget about the bragging rights. Give me the money.
I need to buy some bulk peanut butter.
Exactly.
So, getting back to this idea of building versus breaking, I know you're talking about defensive mechanisms in Capture the Flag games, but then you talk about firewall rule sets and maybe looking at some system calls that are made by various applications. But I'm wondering if there's a way to think about an analog of the capture the flag contest for building security in. You know, the notion would be you're supposed to build something that's going to be attacked or something. I don't know. Have you ever thought about that? How do we teach security engineering in the same way?
Yeah, I think that there are there are different situations in which you develop your skills. For example, there is a competition that is run by the military for the military academies, in which the focus is only on defense. So the basic idea is that the different teams have to keep an operation going while a tiger team that is out of the competition mm-hmm. is attacking them. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they have to build something that has security. They have to be able to deal with unexpected failures and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a different type of competition. It requires, you know, human interaction, and it is scored by human beings with, you know, paper to say, oh, these guys did well, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And it's longer. So what we try to do is something that is shorter in time, sort of is like 8 hours. It's completely automatically scored.
Yep.
So there is no human involved, and so you can scale up as much as you want. And usually the ICTF has a defense and an attack component. There have been, we try to change the design very often. So mm-hmm. part of our sort of like novelty is that we come up, instead of using the same design over and over again, like it has happened at DEF CON in the past few years, we try to come up with completely new designs.
You could use IPv6, for example.
Yeah, exactly. That would be a double disaster. I mean, we imagine running a competition for 8 hours only, and something, if you have one glitch, and you are blocked for 4 hours, half of your competition is gone. you cannot risk certain things.
Yep.
But what I'm trying to say is that there are definitely situations in which that could be done. Mm. And for example, it's interesting. There is a recent DARPA call for proposals to develop security system for protecting Android phones. And one thing that I really liked in that call that I haven't seen in other places, that they have sort of like a tiger team. So mm-hmm. you have to build security in, or the ability to detect security problems in your solution, and then there will be an external part that will come and attack your system,
right,
and attack your the detection capability of your system, so that you have to think defensively.
They put some red team stuff in some of their current calls for proposals, which is
I like that, because after all, you know, in general, when you work with vulnerability and malware, you're going against a human opponent, and that opponent is not just, oh, I'm going to throw at you a lot of code. It's like, hey, I'm going to throw at you the weirdest code you've ever seen.
Right.
So
right.
It's really important to have that, you know, human in the loop there.
Right. So I suppose your hands-on approach to ICTF informs your teaching. You know, that
Absolutely.
Is, do it, don't just talk about it. What's your favorite course to teach?
Well, I mean, my grad course, of course, on vulnerability analysis is the course that I love to teach the most, partly because it is always updated to the latest, greatest technologies and vulnerabilities and security tools. And by upgrading it every year, I sort of keep up with the new stuff. I mean,
yeah, that's great.
5 years ago, return-oriented programming was not as important. Now, you know, it has become the integral part of exploit development.
Mm-hmm.
Other things that were not important, you know, some time ago, like, for example, exploit that are able to tell you the memory layout of a process are now very important with all the memory layout randomization
yep.
techniques that are implemented by most operating systems.
Yep, yep, yep. That's great. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigital.com/GEM, or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. I noticed that you taught a course based on Hofstetter's GEB, Book 2. I don't know if you know, but Doug was my advisor in grad school.
And, oh, cool.
And so, yeah, I wrote one of his AI programs back a million years ago. So how do we attract kind of big thinkers and wide thinkers and people that are sort of well-rounded from a liberal arts perspective and can communicate to our field and not just geeks?
Yeah, that's a difficult question that I think that every computer science department has been struggling with for the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. I think that the trend is actually very positive. I mean, I look at my grad students and they're not necessarily, at least for the most part, a bunch of, you know, closed up nerdy kids. Mm-hmm. No, they're actually very open and very artistic and creative in ways that are not directly related to computer science. I don't know if this is a characteristic of people that love security, that has a little bit of a cloak and dagger, cool, you know, you know that very well.
Could
it's
be.
Much easier to sell a class on, hey, I'm going to teach you how to break into websites,
right,
then, hey, I'm going to teach you how to evaluate the complexity of an algorithm. we have definitely an unfair advantage from that point of view.
Yeah, I've always thought the security sex appeal is very useful for making software engineering not be so boring.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So talking about malware a little bit, is the malware problem still growing? And if it is, why?
Well, it is growing, definitely. Why? Because there's always money to be made, and there are always people that are very naive that use the internet in a naive fashion. And so there are bastards out there that take advantage of people who are not as skilled as you and I. So the basic problem is, A, that as we harden certain platform, for example, Windows 7 is much harder to break into than Windows XP. We come up with new platform like Android phones that allow you to, you know, sort of put new old attack into this new context. Mm-hmm. And for example, there are, you know, a few reports that came out very recently that show that in the past 6 months, the, you know, number of Trojans and Android malware in general has exploded. Mm-hmm. You know, every day there is a new Trojan little malware that sent text to your friends with, you know, URLs to drive-by downloads. Mm-hmm. Or there was there is this Google +++ that apparently, you know, silently becomes a sniffing device. And so it receives a phone call and silently start listening to what you're saying. I mean, it's a new world out there. And it's going to change continuously because the next thing we're going to have, you know, the foobar gizmo. And then we say, oh, I want internet on my foobar gizmo.
Right.
But I'm going to put, you know, an IP stack that has been written in the 70s because I don't have time to do otherwise.
Right.
And suddenly we're back all over again.
Right.
So I don't think it's going to go away.
Right. I don't think so either. That was just a softball question for you. So in 2000, I did this study for the InfoSec Research Council with Greg Morissette. I don't know if you know Greg or not. And we talked about something called Trinity of Trouble, which was just three simple things, networking, complexity, and extensibility, that kind of make the malware problem grow and also make it interesting at all times. But what's striking is those are the three things that make software vulnerabilities more easy to make accidentally. That is, everything mm-hmm. is networked, everything's more complicated than ever, and we have extensible systems like .NET and Java and all that that are everywhere. So there seems to be this kind of close link between software vulnerability and malicious code. Do you agree
with that?
Absolutely.
Oh no, classic presentation is malware riding badware. I mean, malware spreads by, you know, exploiting vulnerabilities in vulnerable software. And so, in a way, there is a link between, if all software was correctly developed, there would be probably very little malware that would be based on social engineering. So, of course, like a fake antivirus,
mm-hmm.
you can build all the protections you want. But if somebody decides,
yeah,
hey,
they're dumb enough to run that, you can't.
I'm going to go buy a gun legally, put it in my mouth, and pull the trigger. I mean, you cannot do much about it. You know, it's terrible. You can educate people, say, hey, you know, don't buy a gun and put it in your mouth. It's not safe. But, you know, my father fell for it, and he has two sons who are professors on computer science.
So, right.
You know, there is little that can be said about it.
Yeah, apparently computer science is not genetic.
No, absolutely not.
So some of your work in intrusion detection involves finding anomalies after baselining a system. And
yep.
I'm sure you're probably aware of Teresa Lunt's work from like a trillion years ago in the early
of
90s.
Course.
Of NIDES and IDES. There was this interesting profile shifting attack where you would move the profile over to the right and then carry out an attack and then very slowly move it back over to the left so that the attack seemed like it was part of normal behavior.
Absolutely.
Are people addressing that problem now in modern detection systems, and how do they avoid that, or is that just something that, you know?
Yeah, there are two complementary problems. One is called concept drift. Mm-hmm. So the one thing is your system is changing in a benign fashion, and
right.
you have to follow it.
Right.
All right, because otherwise, you know, you learn. I don't know, how people use the Wells Fargo banking system on day X, 2 years later, everybody's anomalous because they changed the system.
Right.
And so everything looks weird. So you have to change with the system. At the same time, if you're too proactive in changing with the system, you're vulnerable to these sort of like proactive mimicry attacks where somebody, hey, morphs your idea of normality so that it can have the wiggle room to perform an attack.
Right.
Usually, there is no real silver bullet, no pun intended.
There is now, it's just a podcast.
Yeah, exactly. To solve this problem, I would say that what is common is to find some kind, so to filter out, when you're training, you try to filter out things that you know. So suppose that you don't want to put in your model building traffic some kind of, you know, large-scale scanning or some buffer overflow. If those are things that you know about and you have signatures for,
mm-hmm.
you can filter them out and not use it for training.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, if you don't know what the attack is, you will eventually put it as part of your anomaly model, and you will not be able to detect a real anomaly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's a challenge still.
It is, absolutely.
It sounds like people are working on it in two different perspectives. That's good to know. I haven't kept up with that field. Another question. So I coined this term badnessometer to describe the way you have to be careful about certain kinds of black box testing regimes, dynamic analysis. You wrote this great paper, Why Johnny Can't Pen Test, which seems to come from the same philosophy. So what role should black box testing play in security?
That's a very good question. I think that I look oftentimes at black box testing as a motivational exercise. So it's sort of a hard and fast way to motivate people to understand that security is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody hires a company to perform, you know, black box pen testing on a website and they find a bug, the only thing that you can derive from that is they found a bug.
Right.
But there would tell you absolutely nothing about the stuff that they haven't seen or other, you know, different level of sophistication in their security problems or their security solutions in general.
There's two issues there to untangle, I think. One of them is making sure you don't treat those things as security meters. That's pretty obvious, and that's
mm-hmm.
the whole badnessometer idea. But the other thing is exactly how much of the testing are you doing? That's kind of what you raised as the other really important point.
Absolutely. I mean, and there is no real measure of coverage that you can use if you're really black box.
You can do code coverage analysis.
You're not black box anymore because you know what code you touched.
Well, that's true. So, and it turns out to be something like 10 or 12% if you use the commercial tools that you guys
have. Exactly. Exactly. So I think it's a good way to start a discussion about security. You do black box testing, you find problems, you go to management and say, hey, you know, we have problems. We need a white box analysis of our system. And
mm-hmm.
then in addition to a black box security, you have security engineers like you and, you know, the other people in this community that sit with you in an office. They look at your design. They try to understand what are the security tests that need to be done in order to provide, you know, better assurance about the security properties of a system. Mm-hmm. Of course, even with that, as we all know, you will never get to a point where you say, "Hey, yes, you're done.
You are secure." Right? We all understand that. I think the thing I guess that's appealing about black box testing is you can do it consistently and it's really darn cheap. You know, you put the tests in a can, you just take them out, you run them against some arbitrary program, and you do know if that program fails, it's really terrible.
Exactly. And it's better than nothing. So if somebody says, "Hey, I run these 10 different black box vulnerability analysis tool against my website and I didn't find any problem," I think it's slightly better than saying, "Hey, I know I'm secure."
Right.
You know? Yeah. At least you have 10 data points.
Yeah, so you just have to be careful about how you construe the results, I suppose.
Correct. There's nothing worse than say, "Hey, we have been pen tested by these three kids from high school, so we are secure now and we can handle credit card transactions, no problem."
Because they didn't find any problems.
Exactly. And one of the kids, it was my son. Yeah. That is not going to work.
So you grew up in Italy and moved to the U.S. Correct. Long ago, about 10 years ago now, I guess?
Oh, no, longer than that, but I will not disclose.
Okay, a million years ago.
I moved here when I was 6.
Oh,
and it
I didn't
was
know
20
that.
Years ago.
Okay.
No. Okay. I moved here when I was around 30, and it was, 28, and it was 14 years ago.
14 years ago. So,
yeah.
So the cultures are beautifully diverse in many ways. Can you compare and contrast the attitude towards security found in both cultures?
I'll tell you something that is very interesting. I think there is, of course, Italians are much less technology oriented and sophisticated when they use computers. They're a lot more sophisticated when they are using their cell phones. Uh-huh. I mean, Europeans in general have a better handle of cell phone technology.
Right.
But the other thing that is interesting is that I think Italians in general, because in Italy there is a lot more petty crime than here, uh-huh, in my opinion, people are a lot more diffident. So here there is Americans are nice. So they're trusting, and in general in interaction, first they trust people and that they look, "Oh, is this guy trying to screwing me over?"
Until they're proven wrong, right?
Yeah, exactly. In Italy, you know, if somebody approaches on the street, your first reaction is like, "Okay, who is this guy and why is he talking to me?" So I think that a little bit of that translates to how people use the internet.
Uh-huh.
And I found that the Italians, in general Europeans, and but definitely in the Italian culture, they're a little more skeptical when they see certain things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is I have absolutely no empirical data to support my claim. It's just a gut feeling.
Well, you know, you've lived in both cultures, so I think that's fair enough.
Uh-huh.
So, last question. Rumor has it that your daughter, who is 2, is being taught how to pick locks.
Absolutely.
How good is she at it?
Absolutely not. I will never support that. the moment people know that I'm teaching my daughter how to pick locks, I will get child protective services at my place. Say, "Why is she locked in the first place?"
Oh, you're teaching her by locking her into stuff?
it's a closet. Otherwise, she will never get how to get out of the closet, you know, by picking the lock.
Has she been working on, you know, just rake systems, or has she moved all the way to multiple cores?
No. She's doing the simple stuff now. But I tell you one thing, she's an iPad killer. I mean, she can use the iPad faster than I do, and it's amazing to see this new generation of toddlers using technology.
It really is.
Oh my God! I mean, I cannot imagine this generation. They're gonna look at us typing on our keyboards like, "Okay, you know, my dad was typing on a keyboard," you know, and people will laugh like we were laughing, thinking about, you know, punching cards and things like that.
Exactly. I think that's right. Very good. Well, thanks. This has been fun.
Yeah, for me too. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The July-August issue of IEEE S&P features an article on trustworthy computing, as well as an interview with John Savage. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.